Interview with Leonel, L-E-O-N-E-L, Castillo, C-A-S-T-I-L-L-O, City Controller, Houston, Texas, December 15th, 1974.
Of the Democratic Party delegate process, in Kansas City, we accepted Puerto Rico as a state. And here it is. For the purposes of this charter, Puerto Rico shall be treated as a state containing the appropriate number of congressional districts. That put Puerto Rico up above, I believe, about 20 states, which means that the Latino caucus at the national level of the Democratic caucus, the Democratic Party, doubled its strength, just like that.
That'll be effective in 1980
to 1976. No. And the implementation of this charter, see, after we had the big emotional vote on compromise, on affirmative action and all, everybody was shaking everybody else's hand and being very happy and all. And Chairman Strauss up there read an amendment to the rules that was not in the book, and no one had a copy of it. But the amendment said that the implementation schedule will include that Article 3 would be implemented right after this convention in Kansas City. And Article 3 includes this particular clause through an indirect reference to it, which means that these changes take place right now.
What is the...
That's why some of the Mikulski people later got so ticked off. They realized what had happened was that Strauss had given them a great victory and at the same time had taken it away. It happened to strengthen his hand, and it strengthened the Latino caucus. And one last thing, that question. They also said that there shall be no quotas. Remember that?
Right.
The press. Well, that ain't true either. As a matter of fact, on Article 10, Section 7, Section 6 is the one we fought about. That's this one here, where the big press was. And Section 5 said there shall be no quotas directly or indirectly by national or state parties. Section 6 was a big fight and a big emotional vote. Section 7 says, notwithstanding Section 5 above, equal division at any level of delegate or committee positions between delegate men and women, or committee men and committee women, shall not constitute a violation of any provision thereof. So women are allowed equal division between seats. And Chicanos are allowed, or Latinos are allowed, Puerto Rico and then some other states. Will mean a lot more success in traditional terms, you know, meaning more people in office. And the black gains are going to still continue to be hard-fought, bitter battles with other kinds of alliances, despite the new politics of the Democratic Party. You know, it's still hard-fought. There's some other...
How about the relationship between Chicanos and blacks?
That's a constant problem, and a constant thing to work on. I wrote a paper on this back in 1966 to deliver at the Interagency Committee on Spanish-Speaking Affairs that President Johnson set up, about ways to bring the two groups together, parallel structures and things of that sort. Together, the two groups would easily control most of the big city. Either individually or together, the two groups will control, or could control, most of the major cities in the country, Puerto Rican black in some cases, because of population growth. You've seen it with black mayors, but you haven't seen that happen yet in the big cities. Well, Los Angeles, the first time around, the Chicano community voted for Yorty. Second time, there was emphasis on Bradley, little love. Here in Houston, the Chicano community at first went for Welch and then later Hot Times. It's not as liberal or as monolithic or as much a block vote as is the black vote. The black vote tends to be pretty much solid, strong, predictable.
And liberal.
Yeah. Well, liberal if the Democrats are running are liberal. The black vote has been duped a lot of times, as has the Chicano vote. I mean, we voted for state comptroller for many, many years who never hired a black or a Chicano. And he got 90%+ of all the black votes and all the Chicano votes. And we voted for other guys who are no good bastards, turned out. We just never bothered to see what they did after they got in office. A whole bunch of them, all over the country, I guess. But what I see in Houston, and just interrupt me again if I talk too much or too much off the subject. I see some changes here that are really, really fantastic. You take a thing like that. Population growth, and maybe you've already gotten all of this stuff from somebody else, but if not, in Houston, the Mexican-American population in the last decade grew at a rate of 145%, roughly. The black population grew at the rate of 45%, and the Anglo population at 14%. This trend has continued for the past, or has persisted for the past 30 years, which means that in the very near future, you know, like 15 years, the Mexican-American will outnumber the black in every one of the big cities in Texas. It's already true, of course, in San Antonio and El Paso. And the only cities where this isn't true are Houston, Fort Worth, Dallas. Of the big cities, and it will be true there, you know, in those cities in a matter of time. Add to that the fact that this
is based on birth rate.
No, it's in migration and birth rate.
Principally in migration.
Yes, no one left on a farm, and people are coming from San Antonio and other cities where there are great numerical majorities, and just pouring in here. Plus healthy economies. The other thing that
are any corresponding shifts. On a statewide basis.
Yeah, on a statewide basis, the same growth pattern tends to be true. The Mexican-American growth rate is just zooming. The black rate is also very rapid, but not as rapid. And the Anglo rate is not nearly as rapid overall throughout the state. So that right now, the Wall Street Journal, admitting to its own problems with these statistics, says that one of every five are one of every four Texans has a Spanish surname. One of every five or one of every four. I think the phrase they use, and certainly within a few years, one of every four Texans has a Spanish surname. That's an enormous change, and it's an enormous, it's going to have an enormous impact.
What does that mean in terms of the legislature as well as statewide offices?
In terms of the legislature, it means that we'll see at least that percentage or a little bit higher than that in the legislature, people with Spanish surnames. Although the Spanish surname is deceptive because there are a number of legislators who are Chicanos in the legislature who have English surnames or Anglo surnames, I guess you'd call them. But it'll mean...
Aren't there also legislators with Spanish surnames in the legislature who have nothing to do with the Brown Caucus? So.
Oh, hell yes. That's what I mean by it. Some of these guys are very conservative, and that's the purpose of the lobby. But I think once we hit them with the lobby and hit them with...
Tell us about the lobby again.
Well, the lobby's...
This is something new.
The voice is echoing too much. The lobby is something new, and it's one of many, many new kinds of things that are happening, but... The lobby is an attempt to get all the statewide Chicano groups, the LULACs, the GI Forum, PASOS, the Chambers of Commerce, the Women's Auxiliaries, the Women's Democratic Club, and you know all these sorts of things from throughout the state to come together and set up a full-time paid lobbyist, just like Common Cause and the oil lobby and everybody else, and advocate issues from a different perspective. Namely, the perspective of what's best for the Mexican-American of Texas.
What will be the kind of issues that you see them?
Oh, well, I think one of the crucial basic ones will be school finance, because that affects everybody, but it's a good one. It's also affecting low-income Mexican-American school districts and other low-income school district. So it's good not only because it helps the specific goals of this group, but it's also good because it's a good coalition issue. It's a good one on which you can make ties with blacks and poor rural whites and poor urban school districts. So it's a good coalition issue as well as a good issue. You know, it's got everything with it. Another one that's not as good on coalition, but it's very important, is what's called the illegal problem. And maybe you've heard about this, maybe not, but the Good Neighbor Commission indicates that last year, Texas had 1 million illegals in this state. 1 million. That means that if there are 12 million Texans who are here legally, one of every 13 million Texans that you see is here illegally. So one of every 13 Texans, roughly, is illegal. That's not included in that one of every four that I mentioned earlier, you know, one of every five. That's a whole separate class of people that really are invisible in terms of the census, in terms of provision of services, in terms of all the usual indicators. It's a classic case of the poor subsidizing the rich, the poor being Mexico, and Mexican nationals being the guys who subsidize the economy of Texas. They do all the dirty work, all the exploitative jobs, and they are exploited continuously. The unions want to ship them all out of the United States, penalize the employers. The Mexican-American leadership has taken a somewhat more compassionate point of view. They are brothers, and they have great misery in Mexico. And to send them out of this country back to that enormous misery doesn't seem just somehow, although you can't have them here competing with American citizens for jobs. We're seeing a Mexicanization of the state. And, of course, the migrants are illegals. These are not migrants. These are illegals who go all the way up to Chicago and Toledo and Detroit and all the Midwest, and there are huge colonies up there. And they're slowly but surely moving eastward, so that now you have Mexican-American communities in East Texas, you know, all the way into Louisiana. Right along the border, just kind of go right up to...
These are not American citizens.
No. But over a period of years, they will be. Or their children will be, and their wives, or their spouses, and their ties and all. And they're adding a lot to the community, and they're changing the character of this whole damn state. And slowly but surely, as they drift eastward, and as the Puerto Ricans come westward, and as the Mexican nationals come through California, you know, the country is clearly being Latinized, I mean, very clearly. Although, of course, the Latins are also being Americanized, so we have one strange kind of blend. I don't know exactly what it'll all end up being, but it's not going to be anything we've had before, that's for sure. Anyway, these numbers are just amazing. In the southwest, Texas, when the minorities get control of the cities, as will happen, it'll be very different than in the East and Midwest. If I or a black or any minority person became mayor of Houston, it would be hard, there's no question of that. But not quite like Newark, where the mayor, Gibson, has a 30% of his population on welfare. And the ex-mayor is in prison, and all of these crises, and they can't maintain the streets, and they can't open the libraries, and all those kinds of problems. The cities in which Mexican Americans are located, for reasons that I don't fully understand and probably are not explainable, seem to have healthier economies. Houston is ranked as the healthiest economy in the United States, together with Indianapolis. But Dallas is right up there, and so is Fort Worth. San Antonio, of course, is not. San Antonio is hurt. El Paso is hurt, but that's because of the border problem. Los Angeles is hurt, but not as badly as some of the East Coast. So So I think then of course we've already had some changes in Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado. The Speaker of the House in Colorado is going to be a Chicano this time. Things have changed, you know, and they're changing rapidly, but more rapidly for Mexican Americans here.
So you see a similar proportion in the state legislature?
Or higher.
Okay. What about statewide elected office?
That'll be a little bit harder at first because of the money. It's possible right now to win a statewide elected office. But that's not because of the name, because of the ethnic group, because the system is so screwed up. You can get a... I'm not totally cynical and say you can get a complete bum to be governor, but you can get someone who's not really all that competent or all that experienced or all that astute, but if he has $800,000 or $1 million, he can go a long ways toward winning, or she. And I've been through a number of these statewide campaigns with people who lost on a basis of, primarily because they didn't have the money. It had nothing to do with their issues or their ideological stance or their style of campaigning and all of this stuff we talk about. And I don't even think it's a fact that they're liberal and the other one's conservative. Fact is, they were always outspent. Barefoot Sanders was totally outspent by John Tower. So half the people don't even know who Barefoot Sanders is, except that he's got a funny-sounding name. Sissy, the first time she ran, won in Harris County, 60%. But the farmers, of course, got a whole different set of facts about her. And we had no other material to get out there. Bill Hobby really had no public office experience at all. Worked with the Houston Post here, where he was able to get $800,000 out of his own pocket. And then Dolph Briscoe, if you put him in a competition, he wouldn't win against people with experience enough. He wouldn't be elected spokesman of any group of activists, except that money comes to him. And the Common Cause reforms haven't changed any of that. They have not changed any of that. If anything, they made it harder for low-income people. The great reforms.
In what way?
Well, now you have to document everything you spend. And you have to provide, for one thing, the requirements are more stringent in terms of reporting and all. Well, for a rich guy, that simply means you hire an accountant who takes care of your reporting. For a low-income person, that means you go out and hire an accountant that you can't afford. So you've got another expense, and also the documentation for $5,000, $10 contributions is a lot more extensive than the documentation for $50,000. You know, just five entries on one, and the other is just thousands of entries. And then you'll have to worry about, you'll have more problems complying just because you got to spend and you don't have the money to spend. And that's just a mechanical book thing, a paper thing. There's another problem, and that's it. These reform laws in no instance set limits on how much you can spend. And so they're still going to, the rich are still going to spend more than anybody else, at least in Texas. And the reform laws, so-called, usually, even when they call for disclosure, leave it vague at the end when they say how much you're worth, but you'll know exactly what a low-income person is worth, and all you'll know is that a rich person is rich. See, toward the upper levels of income, they say you don't have to say how many shares of stock you own in AT&T. You can just say it's between 500 and 10,000 or something like that. But it really won't matter when you got that much. Now, they'll know exactly to the penny how much I make, with or without income tax reports. They'll know exactly what I make and what low-income people make. But I won't know what this great big rich guy makes, except that he's very rich. And then finally, they give the illusion of reform, and there is no difference. Maybe the federal laws have changed a bit, but not the local. The local laws have really not changed much at all. So the ball game hasn't changed much. We can out-organize, we can do out-thinking, we can do groundwork, we can do homework, we can do precinct work, and all this sort of stuff, and that'll make up for a lot of the money. But you have to work twice as hard and twice as long if you don't have the money. I guess I'm a case in point. I have to go to... don't have to. I like it as well, though. But I go to events year-round, and I give 3, 4, 5 talks a week. You know, every week of the year. Saturdays and Sundays included. You know, just all year long to get the message across... and also to get some exposure. Now, if I had a lot of money, I could cut that number of meetings by 100, appear on television for 3 weeks, and get twice as much exposure. But I don't have that money, so I go. But you did on foot. You know, it's things like that. The rules have changed a bit, but they haven't changed much at all. No significant impact. And the lobbyist, you know, rules really haven't affected anyone yet. There's been a lot of show and a lot of discussion of reform, but very little reform, is my view. You know, the Common Cause lobbyist is going to go work, according to today's paper, for the newly elected comptroller. You know, that's fine, and I worked for that guy that was just elected. And all. But it, you know, people start to worry already about what happens to Common Cause lobbyists. I don't mean to pick on Common Cause. I paid my membership in that thing, you know. But I just want to make clear that a lot of minority people are not all that excited about Common Cause. It may have helped nationally, and it may have helped on some other things, but as far as helping us politically, it really hasn't that much. As far as opening doors, and we're going to have to win the seats the same way we won them in the past. Same old dirty work, precincts, and mail-outs, and meetings, and phone calls, and all that sort of stuff. But I'm involved in the minority issues more so now than I was in the past, except that I don't run a minority-based campaign in Houston. My constituency is less than 10% Chicano. Most of my constituents are, I guess you'd call them middle-class Anglo, middle America, or white America, whatever you want to call it. And then I have a huge black constituency, 400,000 blacks. Up until this governor was elected, I had the largest constituency of any Mexican-American in the United States. Then this governor of Arizona was elected. Now his constituency was large. But the thing is, I speak on, or try to speak on, what I call populist issues as opposed to minority issues or Chicano issues. And I don't speak a whole lot about Chicano issues. I do, and I don't back off of them, and I don't back off of support on black issues, things of that sort. But I don't, as a priority, focus on that kind of issue. As a priority, I focus on property tax reform, on transit ideas, on efficiency in government, things of that sort, you know, what I call bread and butter issues, picking up the garbage kind of issues. That's what, even spaying and neutering of dogs, that's a kind of issue I like. Makes a lot of sense financially, birth control for dogs, because, you know, if you have all these stray dogs and they're not around, you can save money. By not having them around, I should say. And it's also a good issue emotionally, because everybody gets out there and picks up the messed up garbage in the morning. Some dog knocked over your bag or something, you got to pick up all that junk. And in the middle class, an average citizen relates to that. Plus those dogs scare people as they run around in packs. And it's a serious problem. In developing countries, there's no such problem, because stray dogs are eaten by people. It's food right now. In this country, we we have so much affluence that we have a lot of stray dogs. But
we're just eating dog food.
We eat the dog food because we're poor, but we don't eat the dog. In other countries, they eat the dog. Anyway, that kind of issue I like.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Yeah, I'm a... Well, grew up in Galveston, Texas. Went to college, St. Mary's. Very active in student government there. President of WADI, president of student government. Associate editor of the newspaper. President of the Students for Civil Liberties. That was a demonstration. We used to march and demonstrate. Integrate theaters, 1960, San Antonio. You know, the SCLC, pre-SCLC type stuff then. Then I went to New York, worked for a little bit in the city there, just a little while. And then I went to Peace Corps for 4 years. First group to go to Asia, to Philippines. Worked there as a volunteer, then a volunteer leader, then a staff person, heading up a section of that. Then I came back, went to graduate school at Pitt, got a master's degree there in what's called a community organization through the School of Social Work, primarily, but it's also through the School of Graduate School of Public and International Affairs, Urban Affairs and Studies and things of that sort. I've never done any casework, even though my degree came from the School of Social Work. I've never done any social work, even in school. I've always been in this sort of stuff, planning and organizing. While at Pitt, I worked with the United Negro Protest Committee, which handled things like, well, as the name implies, police brutality, demonstrations, pickets, boycotts, NAACP activity, and things of that sort. And I was lived in a black community there. There were, I guess it was 98% black, and a few of us that were not black. And worked there, even carried signs in 18-degree snow. I can't imagine doing that again. I'd die in that snow. But went from there and got my degree and did some consulting work. Came to Houston, got a job here with a settlement house, community work called Manpower Development. Went from there to another job, same sort of thing, Manpower Development, called Project SED. Then went to work at the Diocese of Galveston, Houston, where they were trying to set up some social service programs and help the bishop with his community service. And I went there to maintain a low profile so that I could go to law school and get educated. And my father was teasing me, said, these other degrees, they don't count for anything. You got to have a profession, like a lawyer or a doctor or an architect or an engineer or something, you know, substantial, a real profession. You know, community organization is not a profession, according to him. And so the first day at work, we started a boycott of the public schools here. And it's a long story, but almost accidentally and inadvertently, I ended up as the chairman of a school boycott of the public schools in Houston. Because the chairman resigned with 15 minutes to go before a big rally. And I was the only one there who was willing to take the job. So we had 4,000 kids out of school. And we ran our own schools, Freedom Schools, Wedgar Schools. And that went on for a while. I got, you know, I was always on TV and radio and everything else because of that. But I, it was all sort of backwards that I got into it. And then, since then, I've just been going for it, you know, going on and on. And I guess I attended not even 1/4 of all the classes at the law school. I passed a few of them, much to my surprise. And I probably could have passed, finished law school if I'd have stayed in it. I'd have been a horrible imposition on any client because I never went to the research class that they had. I think I showed up a total of 30 minutes in the whole semester. Because, see, I was actually in court, handling all sorts of stuff in the jails while the other guys in law school were in law school in classes discussing cases. And I was in actual courthouse being sued or suing or filing charges or whatever. Then I got, I stayed with the bishop and kept working, and I was studying the charter to run for city council. And the more I studied the charter, the more I realized that the city councilman had very little power, very little leverage, and that the real leverage came from the controller, because the controller had all these duties, the right to sign checks, and if they're not signed by me, or by the mayor and the controller, they're no good. No one can be hired unless the controller approves, because I have to certify there's money available. These are about 200 people I'm holding up right now, for one reason or another. I have to make the estimate of revenue, how much money we'll have next year. That has some priorities. And the controller invests all the city's money, a couple hundred million dollars a year. He also does all sorts of things that nobody knew about. He serves as a part I liked. He had the authority to serve as the GAO of the city, the official watchdog. The past controller never did that. Stopped doing it many years ago. So I ran and I won and I started serving as a GAO and I had a ball. First 2 years it was really, really a ball. Every week I'd come up with another Dirty Citizen of the Week award. Find Gulf Oil and Humble or Exxon now. The famous River Oaks Country Club. We have a big country club here. John Connolly type people there. George Bush type people in that neighborhood. It's called River Oaks. It's an exclusive country club, very prestigious. Membership must be about $18,000 a year. Or $18,000 to get in if they let you in. It's a very beautiful place. It's right there. Right here. This is that's the Houston Country Club. There it is here. This whole thing here is River Oaks Country Club. And that was paying less taxes than this neighborhood here, which is third ward, lowest income black neighborhood in the city. So I just had a news conference and said, these bastards aren't paying and they ought to pay. And I showed the official records and all that business, and the mayor defended them, saying that they were prestigious citizens and that they provided aesthetic values to the city, and also that they provided green space. And I said, the hell with the green space, they got to pay just like everybody else. They all objected and so on. Now they're paying. I'm pleased. The big fight this year was over how much they should pay, not whether they should pay or not, which is an enormous step. The assessor-collector...
Before they had been totally exempt.
No, they were paying at a rate that was set in 1954. It was just a ridiculous rate, just way, way down. And I'd take on one of those kinds of things about every week. Last week I took on some big names through one of their charitable outfits. And, they run a kind of an orphanage thing that's been operating since 1920. And they had never paid their water bill since somewhere in 1920, 1930. They owed the city $37,000. In addition to that, $38,000. We were giving them a grant every year. These must have been $50,000 a year that we gave them. These were very rich people, the Taubes. Probably wouldn't mean much to you, but Ben Taub, Henry Taub, these are big names in building Houston. Malcolm Lovett, people on the board of Rice University, things like that. I wanted them to pay their water bill. So they pressured me a little bit about cutting off the water for the orphans and so on. But yesterday they agreed and now they're paying their water bill back then. And I'll give them the grant this year, and then next year I'm going to try to cut them off. A lot of other charities in the city that need money, and why give it to them?
You're how old now?
I'm 35 now. And I get into a whole lot of those things, those kinds of fights. I could go on and on for hours about those fights, because I get it.
So how did you happen to... Like you said, you looked at the chart and saw the city councilman really didn't have much power.
Unless they wanted to exercise it. Yeah.
And the controller did.
Yeah.
And so you decided to run for controller.
Yeah. Also, it was a winnable position. I'm enough of a realist to know what's involved in that, too. The guy had been here since 1945 or so. And he'd worked for the city before that. and he had not had an opponent in 25 years. And everyone assumed he was automatic. Even the head of the Democratic Party at the time thought that he was in an appointed position. He didn't know. So I had a meeting with a group of advisors and asked them what I should do. And being good friends of mine, they unanimously said, forget it. And so I ran anyway. And I won.
When was that?
71. I took office in 72. I have to be fair to the old man now. He'd done a good job. In 1950s, he had fought these same old bastards that I fought in the 1970s. He fought every one of them. And
lost?
Won some and lost some. But he took away limousines from mayors and did all sorts of things. He had not grown with the times, and like so many other elected officials, he'd given all of his life, and it was time for a change. Really was. He didn't think that computers were going to be here to stay, so he didn't really automate the office the way he should have. And a lot of things like that. He just had not upgraded the systems. The GAO part of it, the internal audit, had not been set up, and things of that sort. But he had fought all these guys. You know, the Frank Sharp scandal, and all. He fought him back in the 50s. Because they sold us some water districts that were bad. He'd gone all the way to the Supreme Court, I believe, on that one. The old controller was feisty when he was young and aggressive, you know, and healthy. But he stayed here longer than he should have, and he wanted to retire. And I found $8 million in a bank that drew no interest. Hadn't drawn interest in a number of years, you know, stuff like that. But it was continuous. Now I'm not in the press as much because now my work is more this kind of stuff, and remodeling and renovating and upgrading. And the new mayor, I agree with much more philosophically, but he makes life kind of hard here because he and his staff are not as administratively experienced as was the former mayor's, Welch. I fought with the Welch a lot, the old mayor. The new mayor I don't fight with as much on philosophic basis. But administratively, he just doesn't know as much as the old guy. It's new, you know. He's a new mayor, and even though he's got a PhD in economics and a lot of guys around him. He's doing some of the same things that Lindsay did when he was elected mayor of New York City. All these bright young people all over the place that don't know anything about how to pick up garbage and stuff like that. So I spend a lot more time here now than I used to. And I'm doing more things on other levels now.
What sort of a move toward coalition is there between blacks and Mexican-Americans, or is there?
There is. We've worked on it as long as I've been here and before that. Barbara Jordan is one of the first examples of what that could lead to, although she won on her own right as well as eventually she'll win on her own, regardless of which particular groups are back. There used to be a thing here called the Coalition. It was Labor, AFL-CIO, Teamsters, white liberals, blacks, and Chicanos. And when they were strong, 6 years ago, they used to win every election that they got into. They only concentrated on legislative races, you know, state races, and other races higher than state. They won 22 of 23 seats. Something like that. They got a Chicano elected, they got Curtis Graves elected, Barbara Jordan. They were really good then. But the Vietnam War came and tore the liberals apart. The liberals just broke into factions of doves and hawks and all that sort of stuff. And the labor people were not as solid with all the other groups, and labor is shifting as well. And the coalition's pretty much slowed down. and all the coalitions now are more ad hoc. The Chicano Black Coalition is something that a lot of us work on almost a daily basis, appointing each other to boards and supporting each other for particular positions and things of that sort. It's working very well right now.
And you're speaking now in Harris County specifically?
And even on the national level, the Latino Caucus endorsed all the efforts of the Black Caucus.
How about on the state level in Texas?
On the state level, there is no Latino Caucus. Nor is there a Black Caucus.
Are you going to form one?
That's part of what this is.
I was going to ask you about that.
That's part of
whom does this lobbyist work? Is there
for all of these groups, will be a group. The group will be named something like Mexican-American Political Action Committee or something.
And that will be the basis for a
statewide
caucus?
Chicano statewide caucus.
Is there any sort of association of statewide Chicano elected officials?
There is a statewide, a legislative caucus right now. There is nothing like the Joint Center. We've talked about doing that. The Chicano elected officials tend to represent a much broader spectrum of political philosophies than do the Black elected representatives. My experience has been that the Black elected officials are usually Democratic, usually liberal, whether they're Democratic or not. And usually they vote right in the way I vote on most issues. Chicano elected officials, usually Democratic, usually moderate rather than liberal. They don't vote right except on some issues. We have some people that really have horrible voting records that represent all Chicano constituencies, in terms of what I'd call civil liberties or human rights. We're trying to work up something like the Joint Center. Part of our problem is that we've had more success than the Blacks with less opposition. And a lot of people disagree with me on that statement. But we've had a lot of mayors elected for a long time in South Texas. That hasn't been true in the Blacks in Mississippi and other places. We've had, this last go-round, we had a lot of people elected to different things, even the governors. But the political philosophies are really very different. We'll probably try to put together a statewide meeting of all of the local elected officials sometime in 75.
Would that include legislators?
Yeah. The legislators, they have trouble getting together among themselves, and that's just a handful of them. We'll probably try to be putting that sort of stuff together.
How about the congressmen?
That's very hard to do. Kika de la Garza has a voting record that's comparable to someone who's usually considered very conservative.
How about Henry B?
Henry B has a record that's about as progressive or ADA. Kika would be closer to ACA, and Henry B is ADA. They're probably both 90% on each of those. That's how far apart we are.
But would they join and be part of the statewide?
I don't know. Henry B. doesn't much like to do this sort of thing. And he won't take part in Democratic Party.
What Mexican-American leader in the state does?
Most of them don't.
Why not?
You get cut up when you take part in Democratic Party.
And why are you doing it?
Because I think it has to be done, whether you get cut up or not. And I don't think you necessarily get cut up. The odds are very great. I run for state chairman of the Democratic Party, so I lose. But geez, people, one labor leader said, Castillo, if your guts were cut out and they were on fire, I wouldn't piss on him. 2 months after the election.
Was he opposed to you?
Yeah, he was one of my ardent followers. No, but what's bad is that he worked for me here in Houston. See, your old alliances, your old local alliances start falling apart on the state level. And most elected officials don't want to have anything to do with internal party politics because you can only make enemies. And also because it just takes a lot of time and a lot of aggravation.
Was that your first effort?
That's my first
statewide basis. Actually, why did you do it?
Well, it's kind of cool. I had never even been allowed into a statewide convention, to tell the truth. I went to the 72 convention, the national presidential thing, and I wasn't allowed to be seated because of a deal that had been cut with some people, with Wallaceite people, from my senatorial district. So I went as an observer in 72. 74, the only time I was allowed to enter the convention, I ended up running for the chairmanship. So obviously there's a lot of ego there. But you think you can end up in charge of something you've never even been into. Whereas anybody with sense would know you got to go in there first and be there a little bit. The guy I was supporting was a guy named Bullock. He withdrew with about a week or so to go.
Was the state controller?
Yeah, the state controller. And after Bob withdrew, we had no one who was progressive or liberal to challenge the conservative factions of the state. And my feeling is that if we're going to move this state toward moderate positions, you have to constantly confront the conservatives. You don't have to always win, because you won't, but you have to constantly confront them so that they'll start slowly moving. And also, from that same sort of perspective, minority, particularly Chicanos, but all the other minorities as well, could win more if they had something to bargain from. So that some of my friends told me that they voted against me because the governor offered him something, a position on a board, or a position on a particular, whatever it is, commission or something. And we had that bargaining power. If I hadn't run, there'd have been no bargaining power, or one less thing to bargain away. In that instance, they were bargaining me.